New Horizons is sponsored in part by the Idaho Humanities Council, deepening understanding of human experience by connecting people with ideas.
Today on New Horizons, Gregory Raymond, the Frank and Bethine Church Chair of Public Affairs at Boise State, talking about Afghanistan and Iraq.
States that amass enormous amounts of power are very tempted to try and use the sledgehammer of that power to go after corks that are floating in water. Most people would argue that the surge was a tactical success. It brought down the violence, gave breathing room for the Iraqi government to try and work out some of the political differences that they've had. My concern is we don't want to leave Iraq the same way that we entered.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. Last week's announcement of a new focus for the war in Afghanistan has sparked wide-ranging discussions about what lies ahead for our nation, including what lessons we've learned from the war in Iraq and from Vietnam that are applicable to the situation in Afghanistan. Our guest this week, Gregory Raymond, will help us sort through the comparisons and pitfalls facing President Obama, policymakers, and our troops as they embark on the next phase of the post-September 11th world. Dr. Raymond is the first occupant of the Frank and Bethine Church Chair of Public Affairs at Boise State. Since coming to Boise State in 1986, he has served as Director of the Survey Research Center, Chairman of the Political Science Department, and Director of the Honors College. Dr. Raymond was named Idaho Professor of the Year in 1994 by the Carnegie Foundation and has received Boise State's Outstanding Researcher Award, as well as several awards for teaching excellence. He is the author of 15 books, including After Iraq, The Imperiled American Imperium, published in 2007, and more than 100 articles, reviews, and essays on foreign policy and world politics. Dr. Raymond has lectured at universities and research institutes in 22 countries. Greg Raymond, welcome to New Horizons.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm going to start it this way. It seems like our president has boxed himself in a bit or has been boxed in by a chain of events over which perhaps he doesn't have the control he might like or we might like. As a candidate, he distanced himself from George Bush's Iraq policy, and he did so by taking up the Afghanistan cause. Now he's in office. General McChrystal comes to him and says, we need 40,000 troops, and I think along the way that number was leaked, and we can perhaps talk about that. The president's in a position where he can't blow off a general, and so he has to figure out, how am I going to deal with a 40,000 troop proposal at a time when some people are saying we should no more be in Afghanistan than we should be, we should have been in Iraq. So he can't exit, so he decides, maybe I'll have my cake and eat it too. I'll send in 30,000 troops, not 40,000 troops, and I'll announce a departure schedule, which has caught some people by a bit of a surprise, like, how do you know when you're going to depart when you haven't even sent your troops in yet? Help us understand this dilemma that President Obama has himself in, and please help me understand, correct me if I've gotten some of this story wrong in terms of what options he had before him and how he chose to move forward thus far anyway.
In many respects, I think of the issue of Iraq and Afghanistan like an Alexander Calder Mobile, that there's a delicate balance, that he wants to address one side of the equation, Afghanistan, but in order to be able to do that, he has to draw down some forces and redirect resources from Iraq. We got into Iraq in a very precipitous way. It was an intervention that wasn't preceded by a lot of careful forethought. And my concern is we don't want to leave Iraq the same way that we entered. We want to think this through very carefully. Yes, what happens in Iraq is going to have a bearing upon Afghanistan, but you don't want to leave one area to move to another and then find a flare-up. In the same way that any good forest fighter knows that you want to make sure everything is put out in one region before you redirect your resources mm-hmm. to another region. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the dilemma he finds himself in, that there aren't enough resources to to continually push on both fronts. We've put our troops through multiple tours of duty. And so his hope is to be able to exit one area in order to bolster the other area.
Your book, After Iraq, you've written it with Charles Kegley, who is with the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. The printing date is 2007, so you probably finished it up in 2006, and now you can have 3 years to look back on it and see how right you guys were and how wrong you guys were. But I'm reading the back jacket here, and it certainly sounds interesting to me and somewhat prescient on your part when you say it demonstrates that these dominant states being states like the United States of America, were often woefully uninformed about the cultures of their adversaries, rushed to military action without an adequate appreciation of the problems they might face, and made scant effort to prepare contingency plans in case their efforts were derailed. Like the U.S. today, these states once stood at the pinnacle of world power, but due to misperceptions about what they could accomplish with military power, they made short-run decisions that undermined their long-term strategic interests. How does that apply to Afghanistan today?
This is an old problem that we can trace all the way back to the first major states that we have in recorded history. States that amass enormous amounts of power are very tempted to try and use the sledgehammer of that power to go after corks that are floating in water. And that creates enormous difficulties and splashovers that often aren't foreseen. As I look back at at Iraq in the period after the book was published, the main thing that has happened is the surge. The book was written prior to the surge. It looked at the time that we were on a path that had no prospect for success. And then the Bush administration did an about-face in terms of moving towards the surge. The major thing about the surge, however, was not necessarily sending in the five combat brigades to increase the numbers, but rather there was a change in strategy. We had aspirations in the past that were masked as strategy. But what happens beginning in 2007 is we actually begin to formulate a strategy that's tailored to the conditions that we faced in Iraq. And there are a number of people who should be credited for this. Jack Keane, a retired general, Ray Odierno, the current commander in Iraq, David Petraeus, the theater commander. These three people were crucial in promoting a new strategy. It was not that we had more troops, but that was certainly necessary. But it was how we were going to use them that was important. And that represented a fundamental change from what we had been doing up to that point.
So have we tailored our Afghanistan strategy accordingly?
Well, the Afghanistan strategy certainly builds upon what happened in Iraq. And the important thing to bear in mind about Iraq was, in the past, we had relied heavily upon massive firepower. We had not done much to understand the differences that might exist among our adversaries and how we could insert a wedge to widen those differences. We didn't really pay much attention to the most important principle of counterinsurgency, and that is protect the population. With the surge, with the additional 30,000 so troops, we also began to change how we deployed ourselves. Instead of being in fortified bases, we began to deploy in towns, in smaller bases. We began to go on patrol with Iraqis. We began to know the neighborhood. And with that, we got intelligence that we didn't have before, because the locals know who is who. And the locals have a good sense of where, for example, improvised explosives might be planted. And if you can get them to believe that you are working on their behalf, then they can provide you with information that you didn't have before. The paradox is sometimes by working so hard to build up your own security, you become less secure. By deploying in and among the people, you can actually increase your security. In the short run, you're going to take frightful casualties. But in the long run, you begin to get the local population working on your behalf.
But it does sound like what you've just described is what we've all been hearing the Obama administration describe as their approach in Afghanistan, and especially the military commanders over there. Is that
correct?
Yeah.
Nothing succeeds like success. And most people would argue that the surge was a tactical success. It brought down the violence, gave breathing room for the Iraqi government to try and work out some of the political differences that they've had. They have not been completely successful in that regard. And so at the strategic level, we might say that the surge still gets a grade of incomplete. But nonetheless, at the tactical level, it brought down violence. And I'm convinced that the Obama administration, many of whom were not in favor of the surge initially, have concluded that it's worth a try in Afghanistan, even though the conditions are quite different. Iraq has a history of a more centralized government than Afghanistan. It's a more urban population, a more developed population, higher levels of literacy, and so forth. But nonetheless, what's happening in Afghanistan has not been successful, and so therefore, why not give this a try?
Well, that point you make about Iraq being a little bit more of an urban population brings me to my next point, and that is that from what I can tell, from what we hear, the focus of the Afghanistan efforts over the course of this next year or so, it's going to be in that area that has been dubbed Pashtunistan, the border areas, the border between Iraq and Afghanistan that is so rugged, so mountainous. That is really tough terrain, very difficult, much more difficult, I would think, than Iraq. I know Iraq wasn't exactly easy, but nonetheless, when you take 30,000 more troops, I mean, again, I hate to use the Vietnam analogy, but at one point we had 500 and something thousand troops in Vietnam and we couldn't pull it off. And I would even argue that Vietnam might have been easier terrain than this Pashtunistan area. Your thoughts on that?
Extremely difficult terrain and very different from both Iraq and Vietnam. And in fact, the terrain is such that there's a different tempo to the fighting there, that the fighting in Afghanistan tends to have a more cyclical property to it, largely because when the winter hits, things slow down. Whereas in the case of both Iraq and Vietnam, there was a more consistent level of fighting that took place. There are also difficulties in terms of logistics, getting the troops and material into the theater and where you want them. This is a problem that the Russians ran into when they were involved in Afghanistan. They were configured to fight a war on the North German plain, and they brought in all of their armor and heavy equipment, and they found that the opposition didn't fight in the way that they had planned. Their best weaponry were armored helicopters, and that weaponry lost its effectiveness once the Stinger missiles began to show up in the hands of the Mujahideen. So this is an extremely difficult place. As one military writer has put it, Afghanistan makes Iraq look easy.
You're listening to Dr. Gregory Raymond. He is the occupant of the Frank and Bethine Church Chair of Public Affairs at Boise State, a professor of political science, former director of the Honors College. He's the author of the book After Iraq, The Imperiled American Imperium. Let's talk about the supposed American troop pullout of Iraq next year. This situation in Afghanistan, you have to wonder, is one going to be affected by the other? First of all, a lot of us, I think, have lost track of Iraq. I mean, we are so focused on listening to all of the news coming out of Afghanistan and out of the White House about Afghanistan that what's going on in Iraq is put off to the side a bit, except, of course, when there's a report of a bombing and casualties on the American or the Iraqi side. Help us understand where we are today in Iraq, and do you think that this new surge in Afghanistan is going to make our conclusion to the Iraq war effort more difficult?
Well, here's where we stand right now. At the beginning of November, the Iraqis put together a new election law. It became very controversial. One element of it was to hold what were called elections that would allow people to vote for individuals rather than parties. the feeling was on the part of the United States that this was a major step forward because it would hold legislators accountable to their constituency in a way that they wouldn't be accountable if the constituents voted for parties rather than individuals. And here we have to credit the role of the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, who played a significant behind-the-scenes role in moving the Iraqis towards this type of format. Well, once that was agreed upon, a date was set for the next elections. That was to be in mid-January. Then difficulties began to occur. One of the difficulties pertained to the number of seats that would be in the parliament. The old parliament had 275 seats. The new parliament was to have 325. One seat would be allocated for each 100,000 citizens. The debate that broke out would be the treatment of Iraqis who were both internal and external refugees. With all the violence that had occurred recently, a number of Iraqis had fled their hometowns, some of them into neighboring countries, some of them into other parts of Iraq. There was a concern, how do we count those individuals? On top of that, there was the issue of the Kurdish population believing that their election rolls did not adequately represent the number of Kurds who actually were in the area of Kirkuk and the province of Kirkuk. So a big debate broke out over how do we go about allocating seats? What voter registry do we use to determine the population of each particular region of Iraq? In order for this electoral law to pass, a presidential council made up of one Sunni, one Shiite, and one Kurd had to unanimously approve it. The Shiite member of the presidential commission voted against it. He vetoed this plan. It went back to the drawing boards. A new plan was proposed, which actually disadvantaged the Sunnis even more. He threatened another veto. They went back to the drawing board. Just 2 days ago, at an emergency meeting, a final plan was hammered out in which out of these 325 seats in the parliament, 15 would be set aside for special cases. 8 would be set aside for ethnic groups that were small minorities scattered around the country. And the remainder would be set aside for the refugee community, which are primarily Sunnis who had left during the civil war that broke out. So as we stand right at this moment, the election has been moved back from the middle of January to the 6th of March. The United States came out and said we would begin to draw down troops 60 days after the election was held. We would promise to hold our current level of about 115,000 troops there for 60 days. But then beginning in the summer, we would start drawing down our combat troops. We have signed an agreement with the Iraqis that we'll have everybody out of there by December 31st, 2011. That may be optimistic, but that's where we stand right now.
You mentioned those elections. I must say that I'm probably a bit of a cynic when I hear a country in as much turmoil as Iraq with no real democratic traditions in place, at least the way we in the Western world look at our democratic traditions of elections and holding people accountable to the offices they've held. Are those elections really the elections we here in America describe as elections, or are they a different breed of cat?
We tend to look for what are typically called in the jargon metrics, things by which we can measure our progress. And for the emergence of a new regime somewhere, we gravitate towards elections as the key metric to look at. And we often feel that if elections are successfully held, then that bodes well for the development of a more democratic state. The difficulty is, if I could use a parable, the difficulty is if I wanted to create a forest and I purchased 100 trees and I planted them all, would that constitute a forest? No, because a forest is more than trees. It's a complex ecosystem that involves various types of insects and mammals and reptiles, amphibians, as well as much more plant life than just trees alone. So planting a lot of trees by itself doesn't create a forest. Holding a few elections by itself doesn't create a democratic political system. It may be one element of it, but we shouldn't get carried away thinking that just by virtue of having some elections, now the job is done and we can leave the country and be satisfied that things will be stable and that a democracy will take root. Mm-hmm.
Greg, let's focus for a moment on the attempt by the United States in the Iraq War to get the support of allies and the commitment of troops. That was a rocky road, to say the least, and Western Europe especially did not come along as George Bush had hoped. Sum up for us, if you will, where we stand today, who's in Iraq as far as our allies are concerned, what kind of multilateral effort that is, and more importantly, looking forward or looking immediately at Afghanistan, what can President Obama expect? I haven't kept up with the developments on who's been signing in and who's been signing out of the Afghanistan.
Well, in Iraq, it's down to basically us. If you want to look for a more multilateral effort, you would have to go to Afghanistan now. Virtually everyone has drawn down their troops in Iraq except for us. And in the case of Afghanistan, there is a NATO commitment to provide troops. In fact, the Obama administration had hoped that the extra 10,000 to reach the total of 40,000 that would be placed on top of the 30,000 that we would provide would come from NATO. In all likelihood, those troops are going to be used for logistics, perhaps used for training the Afghanistan army and police. They will probably be deployed to the more secure areas of Afghanistan. I think once again the heavy fighting will be done primarily by the United States.
Regardless of the doubts that a good number of people have about going into Afghanistan, your mention of NATO certainly does change the events of Afghanistan from what was going on in Iraq, because it was so difficult to get support for Iraq. I wonder if you could describe for us, and this was probably very difficult to do, is there any consensus in the so-called foreign policy community, your colleagues who write, observe, and analyze about American foreign policy and Afghanistan in particular, is there any consensus that has developed in just these few weeks since President Obama announced his policy on whether this is workable or unworkable? I mean, I know the Republicans and Democrats are fighting, and that's to be expected. That's what a two-party system is going to produce. But among those of you who study this and study it carefully, I'm just wondering if there is any consensus at this point.
There is a huge debate. That great philosopher Yogi Berra once said, prediction is always difficult, especially about the future. And people both in the military community and in the policy community are engaged in an enormous debate about the issue of counterinsurgency and how successful it might be. And what's interesting is this is a debate that has resurrected a lot of the old ideas from Vietnam. It begins with two personalities, General Westmoreland, who pioneered the search-and-destroy strategy, and his replacement, Creighton Abrams, who in 1968 pioneered clear-and-hold as a strategy. The debate within the military community is, to what extent, if clear-and-hold had been done sooner rather than search-and-destroy, could the Vietnam War have ended in a different way? And there is a massive debate within the literature on this, with one school of thought saying, yes, we simply ran out of time on the clock, that if we had more time to pursue the strategy of clear and hold, we would have been able to turn the corner. And then another school of thought saying, no, the war was over by that point. It was not possible. And what's happening today in Afghanistan is a revisiting of that argument. Clear and hold was an earlier version of the counterinsurgency strategy that David Petraeus promoted it first in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. The idea of the so-called ink spot notion that you move your forces into a particular area, you clear it out, you bring in trained locals to hold it, then you move to an adjacent area, clear that out, bring in trained locals to hold that area, and you gradually then begin to spread across the map like an ink spot on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
That has its roots all the way back in the Creighton-Abrams strategy in Vietnam. But at the same time, there's another school of thought that is reflected by the 1983 Weinberger Doctrine right after the catastrophe that happened in Lebanon, and also in the 1990s in the Powell Doctrine, the notion of using overwhelming force, that we have an advantage in firepower, we have an advantage of control over the skies, and that we should go in with everything we have and have a clear exit strategy, clear objectives in mind, and not get bogged down into this type of counterinsurgency operation. Mm-hmm. And this debate is a really vigorous debate that's going on right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, until I prepared for this show, I wasn't aware of this debate and the clear and hold strategy component of it. And it does raise in my mind the question of whether or not a good number of journals, books, biographies that have been written declaring some of those characters from the Vietnam War to be the scoundrels and the culprits that they were, who knows, might be rewritten someday?
Well, this is why historians always tell us it's very hard to see our own time clearly. And when I look back to that period of time, my views are very much colored by the experience that I was going through. A student at the time concerned about the direction of U.S. foreign policy, a person who was eventually drafted out of graduate school and served 2 years in the military during that period. And so as I look at Vietnam today, I'm able to see it in a little bit broader perspective than I was able to see it back at that period. And I imagine people will look back at Iraq and Afghanistan in the future historians, and see things a little bit more clearly than we see them today. But I'm very much concerned that we are very quick now to try and bring to a conclusion Iraq. And my sense is that history isn't finished with us. This is an area of the world that produces more history than it can consume. Mm-hmm. And even if we begin drawing down our troops, there's much yet to happen. Some writers, Tom Ricks, for example, who's written probably two of the best books about Iraq, has suggested in the epilogue to his most recent book, published in 2009, that he believes that the most important events of Iraq have yet to occur. And that creates certain fears as well as certain hopes. Maybe these events are events that will turn in a direction that is very positive, but there's the possibility that they won't. The RAND Corporation, which has studied these sorts of policies for many years, recently concluded there has been no successful counterinsurgency operation that was completed in under 10 years. And if that's the case, if this pattern holds, there is much yet to happen in Iraq in the future. And we may draw down most of our combat units, but we may wind up with a residual force there for much longer than December 31st, 2011.
Well, Greg, we've run out of time. I can't tell you how fortunate I think we are here at Boise State to have you on our faculty and the great work you do as a teacher, as a researcher. You're obviously known far and wide, way beyond Idaho, and the work you do is just a credit to all of us here at Boise State University. Thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much.
Next week, Richard Norton Smith, past director of 5 presidential libraries and a nationally recognized authority on the American presidency. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.